Now we come to the lecture of the 11th of May 1917. Rudolf Steiner starts by indicating that it is his intention to give people a much more expanded understanding of all the events that are going on in our present time. And I will continue this amplification in the lecture on the next Sunday. But before doing this, we would like to answer the question, what is it that we are seeking when we select the path into the anthroposophical movement? Well, we seek on this path to acquire the possibility of finding a relationship to the spiritual world which correspond to those requirements which are born into us for this spiritual world out of the forces, out of the life relationships of the present time. Generally speaking, no one comes to us, and this is very superficial, who is not inspired to require, to acquire a relationship to the spiritual world. People study spiritual science in order to establish some relationship to the world of the spirit, and thus to be able to find a connection with Christ Jesus, a connection which they are unable to find within the Christian churches. The hearts of many people are subconsciously yearning for that anthroposophy which is able to answer their hidden questions. Anthroposophy absolutely originates out of the realization, out of the knowledge, that in our time there exist searching souls who only upon the paths of anthroposophy are able to find that which they are looking for. There is an unconscious yearning in many souls to seek for the greatest impulse of earth development, to seek for the Christ impulse, to recognize, to cognize this Christ impulse on those paths which are appropriate to the requirements of our present age. The path towards the Christ impulse to be found in such a way which the heart itself is yearning for when it really wants to stand within the life relationships of the present time. What I've just told you in the first place can appear very abstract, but the real thing involved here is to permeate one's soul with the spirit of the words which I've just expressed to you, in order that these words just do not remain merely abstract, not merely theoretical, but that these words which I've just expressed to you can become the content of our whole life, and above all can become the content of our Gesinnung, of our whole attitude. My dear friends, I would like to give you an example of something which is characteristic for our age. Now, in a certain city in South Germany, I gave a lecture once entitled The Bible and Wisdom. And in this lecture, I attempted to explain how the positive Christian human being, precisely when he understands himself, can find the way to anthroposophy, insofar as I depicted how anthroposophy, through its presuppositions, penetrates much deeper in that great book, that great book of the Bible, that primal book of mankind, that Bible, whose depths of content, whose mysteries which are in the Bible can never be exhausted. After the lecture, two Catholic priests approached me and said they've got really nothing to object to as far as this lecture that they just heard. Or we can say that when we speak, then we speak in such a way that everybody can understand what we say. We speak for the general population. But I responded to them by saying, do all people come to your church? You claim to speak for all people. Why is it that everybody, not all people, do come to your churches? I must admit, there are a considerable number of people who do not go to your churches. Well, it's for those very people that we are speaking for and to. These people, those people who cannot see their way clear to go to your churches, surely they too have a right to be able to find the path towards the Christ in our present age. That's what I told them. But you see, my dear friend, anthroposophy wants to be nothing other than to give an answer to the questions, those questions which perhaps human beings themselves do not consciously place, but which nevertheless appear as questions in the hearts of those souls in our present age, if they really could understand themselves properly. And in my writings, I have not placed answers to questions which people do not have. It's true, I have presented the answers, but the questions were not placed by myself. Questions are placed precisely by those people who are produced by our time culture, particularly those people who have been influenced by the natural scientific approach in our age. Questions placed by those people who have a real interest in the demands of our age, who want to completely, earnestly involved in the most important requirements of the souls of our present age. I ask you to examine our anthroposophical writings, not with a goodwill, but try to examine them with a critical approach. That very critical approach which one can acquire out of our present time culture. If you do that, then you will find one kernel point, find present one central point in the whole of our anthroposophical literature. And this central point focuses itself on trying to bring to the human soul that which the human soul above all things really demands and requires in our present age, namely Selbstständigkeit, independence, the power of judgment out of one's own inner being. My dear friends, quite often I've had to resist the urge which has been pushed upon me by this side or that side, requiring and emphasizing that I should write in a much more popular way. I've always resisted these urges for the simple reason because the real thing doesn't concern itself to give human beings within our anthroposophical literature, to give human beings articles of faith, which people can very readily bring some sort of superficial understanding to. No. In our literature, in our anthroposophical literature, we concern ourselves to be able to stimulate the actual power of judgment, to stimulate the searching of one's own soul. Everybody can convince themselves of this fact if they just study our whole anthroposophical literature. Anthroposophical writings are intended to develop independence of judgment. Hence, they're not written in a popular style which would appeal to human gullibility. You have to stop, you have to think very hard before you can understand what is in our anthroposophical literature. Spiritual facts are presented. You can look at these spiritual facts, but you do not of necessity have to accept these spiritual facts. You can live with these facts for a while and then see how you feel about them. This is entirely different from just a mere dogmatic acceptance of some superficial truths and dogmas. I'm not trying to call forth a blind belief. It's true that certain things are told, are imparted, which cannot be tested without further ado. However, they are related and imparted as facts of the spiritual world, which each person can take as Mitteilungen, as reports. And he can always, if he wants to, apply to these reports his critical measuring rod. Perfectly willing to subject our reports, our communications, to a non-prejudiced critique. Time and time again, I insist, test these things. Proof it. Consider them, weigh them. Above all, try to enter into these things deeper and deeper with the means of your present thinking. Because this is what has been striven for from our side. For that reason, the writings of our anthroposophical literature precisely have the effect of making people much more selbstständig, independent. The new ideas always receive a certain innate rejection because they're new. People prefer to listen to the pulpit express all sorts of ideas which they have for a long time already recognized and accepted. But if they permit anthroposophical truths to live within their soul, then if they're prepared to burrow deep within themselves, they would realize that anthroposophical truths do not originate from one particular person's opinion, but anthroposophical truths reflect factors which are connected with mankind's evolution. More than one occasion, people have come to these lectures, and when they're asked about these lectures, they respond, they said, actually, I were afraid that if we really were to go much more deeply in the situation, we're afraid that we might be convinced about it. This feeling really points to rather significant facts. What we are attempting to do is to try to free people from the inherent evil of our age, namely the setting up of personal opinions, of personal theories. What we're trying to do is to release people from that and to direct the souls to that which is said by the spirituality of the world. If we find the possibility of devoting our whole soul to the spirituality of the world, and to do this, we try to speak of the methods, of the actual methods which will enable the souls actually listen to the spirituality of the world. But unfortunately, we have prejudices. The souls of so many people have so attached themselves to that which they have been accustomed to. And so they're quite satisfied when, in water clarity, they can hear things preached from the pulpit, and can say to themselves, yes, what I've heard, I've already myself long thought about. Such truths, which have long been thought about, to be sure, cannot be found at the present time in the teachings of anthroposophy. For all these reasons, it's quite understandable that are quite resistances and barriers arise when human beings attempt to enter into anthroposophy, into the science of the spirit. My book, entitled How One Arrives at, Achieves Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How One Acquires Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, that book, in the course of a time, has been read by a large number of people. Not only by those circles attached to the Anthroposophical Society, but many people outside these circles have read this book. Sometimes I get very nice letters from people, but when I read these letters, I realize that they really have not understood the contents of this book. They have transferred or transformed the most important things present in this book into the materialistic attitude of our present age. The book, The Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, was written so as to enable an individual to find his own way into the spiritual world by removing those obstacles which prevent it. However, people prefer to have authorities who definitely tell them what to do, specifically, in detail. But they don't want to learn the principles involved. They don't want to learn those principles which, if they did learn them, would make them independent of an authority. So many people read the book, then they hook on to one particular sentence. The sentence which says, that person who has received, who has entered into, who has the necessary ripeness and maturity, that person will find, if he only seeks in the correct way, he will be able to find his spiritual teacher. They respond, ah, now we've got it. All we have to do is to write a letter to the person who wrote this book. He'll be my spiritual teacher. Now, that's so very simple. Well, in doing that, here we have a transformation of something in a materialistic way. This particular sentence was written for people who are independent, and the intention was that this sentence would give people the sacred drive to look further in order to find a way which perhaps consists in something different than just to write a letter to someone and ask him and say, please give me instructions. I wrote that sentence in order to perhaps inspire people to look further, to seek further. But that's too inconvenient for people. The trouble is, so many people have read this book, and the book has been translated in different languages. But this book has been very greatly misunderstood. People just want to receive instructions, but they don't want to trouble themselves to learn the actual principles. If they learn the principles, then they would be able to give themselves their instructions. But they prefer to have someone else prescribe for them, without having to try to test or examine the principles given by the person from whom they want to get their instructions. In that way, they are delivering their destiny to that person who places himself upon authority. Rarely that people who are looking for these instructions from other people, it's rare for them to examine these other people and ask them upon what principles are they basing for their so-called spiritual instructions. It's much simpler to have faith in the other person and then apply the principles in a very automatic way. As I say, you give over your destiny to someone else. The reverse of that independence which is striven for in all of our anthroposophical writings. We don't give you instructions, we give you the principles. You yourself make your own instructions by examining carefully what the principles are that are involved in this. Modern natural science has helped to develop a logical sequence of thinking in human beings who study natural science. From this type of testing and proving, anthroposophical spiritual research hasn't the slightest fear. It'll be able to hold up on this genuine testing. But the important point is to add to the urge to be logical, another urge to think in accordance with reality. And that means to allow our judgment to be guided not only by an abstract logic, but by sinking oneself into reality. And this urge very few people possess in our age. Trying to be logical, yes, many people strive towards logic. However, it's only when you go behind this logic is one able to be possible to see the, to have an insight into the tragweite of the logic, into the range of this logic. You can work out with your thinking power a certain batch of judgments which have a logical coherence. But nevertheless, those very judgments can lead to confusion if you have not sunken yourself into reality. There was a situation in which Charles the Austrian and the French king Franz I once were completely agreed in reference to a certain thought which they wanted to realize. And the French king Franz said, "My dear brother wants the same thing as I do. We both want the same thing." What was it that they both wanted? They wanted to conquer Milan. They both were very logical, but both their logic could produce a collision between both of them. And that is an example, but that can be applied to many of the judgments which are swirling around in the thinking of present-day mankind and are producing the troubles of our age. A person who has some sort of sense for the living, that which really lives in thinking, feeling and willing, for many years recently, that person can have real pains when he's exposed to the formulation and the way of much thinking which occurs in our present age. My dear friends, I still remember when I heard my first lecture in Vienna about the teaching of elliptical functions. Please excuse me using this. The important point is not for you to understand what elliptical functions are, but to get the sort of spirit is what I want you to understand. So at that time I heard the lectures by the well-famed Professor Leo Königsberger. Leo Königsberger was so famous that just as soon as he was named as a professor, he was able to write to the Regierung, the government, to the authorities, that he would like to have been selected as a privy councillor, not just to be a professor. Now, when I heard Königsberger's first lecture, he arrived at the question as, how does it relate itself with numbers? People assume positive numbers, negative numbers. Thus, positive numbers, they correspond to the money which I possess, negative numbers to the money which I do not possess, but which I owe. Nevertheless, in addition to that, there are still other numbers. The mathematicians designate through a line in whose middle they write zero. The positive and negative numbers they designate plus one, plus two, minus one, minus two. And added to that, the famous Gauss still added a new line of numbers. Now we have a certain dot dash in the manuscript, meaning something must be omitted, so that people can fill out the surface with different kinds of numbers. I'm not going to talk about the justification of this number surface. However, Leo Königsberger at that time began his lecture about the elliptical functions insofar that he said the following. It could now be possible that today some would say that one could also assume, just as validly, numbers at right angles to this surface. When I was quite a young man, of about 16 and 17 years old, I learned the story connected with the surface numbers. And at that time, I already made the following objection. And when I responded, indeed, then one could consider rather the whole space filled out with numbers. However, my teacher, in a friendly way, calmed me, gave me beruhigte mich, placated me, mollified me in a friendly way, insofar as he said, now, you just wait right into the next century. And that, when my teacher said that to me, obviously, being a young man, that made a great impression upon me. Now, I heard the same question dealt with by Leo Königsberger in Vienna. He said, let us assume that there exist these three kinds of numbers. Not only the numbers which lie in the surface of both lines, but numbers which lie in the third dimension. We hypothetically assume that there exist such numbers. We assume the hypothetical existence of such a number, and I would multiply such a number by another number. Now, I will show you that if you multiply these numbers, the product of the multiplication can be zero under circumstances. Since that could never really be in reality, so therefore no such numbers can exist. You must realize, to hear somebody talk like that, that's a great pain. I'm not going to say whether the whole story, whether the whole process is correct or not. However, when you assume one thing, assume that another number cannot exist because the product of multiplication is zero, well, to hear something like that, that's quite a pain. Because obviously, one must assume that when you have two numbers which produce zero, then you must assume that the zero was able to arise through multiplication, not the reverse. That must be the immediate conclusion. Whether we find such judgments like this, such ridiculous judgments like this in the realm of mathematics, or if we find such ridiculous judgments in political notes, for example, the notes of President Wilson, such judgments always lead back to the same type of thinking. And however, these same type of form of judgments are applied in realms which are significant for the destiny of mankind, then such an error in judgment signifies something quite different from an error in a merely limited scientific speculation, as is the situation in the theory of Leo Königsberger. I told you all this in order to bring your attention to the fact that the characteristic of our age is that you have human beings do not adapt their judgments to the realities. They do not wish to live in reality because they do not want to apply reality in the most simplest things. They want to presuppose, in the case of the simplest things, that which they like, but not that which produces itself out of reality. The fact that in many connections one must learn to think differently if you want to extricate yourself from the misery of the present time. One must be able to learn not merely to have thoughts about everything, but one must learn to think differently. And this is most important. If these people with their old habits of thought, could really try to understand the anthroposophically orientated science of the spirit, then they would much quicker be able to live themselves into spiritual scientific truths. These spiritual scientific truths cannot be approached with the old habits of thought, but they must be approached precisely with a new thinking. Differently, if you want to extricate yourself from the misery of the present time, one must be able to learn not merely to have thoughts about everything, but one must learn to think differently. And this is most important. If these people with their old habits of thought could really try to understand the anthroposophically orientated science of the spirit, then they would much quicker be able to live themselves into spiritual scientific truths. These spiritual scientific truths cannot be approached with the old habits of thought, but they must be approached precisely with a new thinking. And this seems to be very difficult for many people. So these are parts of the reasons why it is very difficult in the present time to come to terms with the anthroposophically orientated science of the spirit, because it must impinge immediately. You find you're up against the most immediate prejudgments and prejudices. But precisely because the situation is like that, so the science of spirit actually is not battled, because the battling of to resist, because the resisting of spiritual science, one must realize that you stand, when you resist spiritual science, you're standing on very weak feet. Try to investigate those scientifical discussions which attempt in an earnest way to deal with spiritual science as it is there. Just seek such theses of this caliber, and the person who occupies himself will see how very few of them go in this direction. But perhaps it might not be at all convenient to go forward in this direction. Just see, some years ago, a student told me, a student who wanted to make his doctor degree as a philosopher at a well-known university. He wanted to write a dissertation which he was advised by a well-known professor. And this dissertation is supposed to deal with the great Russian thinker, Solovyov. At that time, Solovyov was not, the people knew very little more about, the people at that time knew not much more about Solovyov than just a few lines which Lena Hoffman wrote. But later on, much more came out. I asked the student, tell me, why did the professor give you the advice to make this dissertation on Solovyov? And this is what the student told me. Because the professor knew nothing about this philosopher, and so he wanted to learn something about it. That's how they do it. You advise a student to write a doctor's thesis because the student happens to know Russian, and so the professor can learn something from the student. And that's how the doctor thesis wrote on Solovyov. And approximately out of the same attitude, many doctor theses have their origin. It was much more inconvenient for the professor to study Solovyov himself, and so he gave the task to a student. Similar way, it's inconvenient for many people to get their own evaluation about the science of the spirit. It's too difficult for them, and so they listen to what other people say. It would be a much better idea for the professor to give in his student the task of writing a doctor's thesis on the science of the spirit. Then he really would be able to learn something. But many people have attempted to occupy themselves with the science of the spirit. And as a general rule, they have not become opponents. They certainly haven't become blind followers. But nevertheless, they haven't become opponents. The fact is that a major proportion of our contemporaries have a most personal interest in eliminating science of the spirit, to make it impossible for the science of the spirit to have an existence in our present time. And when these opponents really talk about the anthroposophical science of the spirit, they lead the thing over into the personal domain, and they don't discuss about that which actually is the content of the science of the spirit. But they speak about all sorts of other things. And this will increase more and more in the near future, because things will happen that many people who have become dissatisfied with anthroposophical spiritual science and have become dissatisfied for out of personal reasons, these dissatisfied people can very easily become instruments for those who want to eliminate anthroposophy from the world. People who avoid the honest ways, who avoid entering into really scientific discussions, but instead of that, they'd focus upon some kind of scandal in our movement and try to transpose everything into the personal element. It's very important for us to realize how the opponents work. We have to enter into these things much more exactly. For example, I can tell you a human being. Some years ago, his name appeared for the first time before our eyes. He originated out of a small city, and Frau Dr. Steiner received one day a letter, as so often happens, and the letter said, "I feel very unhappy in my position. I'd like to make my position better." And one of these letters, which had this sort of tone, asked for advice in order that he can do things better, whether he should go into a certain house, or he should marry into a business, or in some other way to improve his path in the world. But we had to tell him that we really don't occupy ourselves with such questions as to whether a person should marry somewhere or not. But since he didn't give up, we tried to meet his requirements by giving him certain spiritual teachings. But as soon as he began to devote himself to spiritual things, he came to the opinion that really, for such a great spirit as himself, it wasn't good to do any business in a small city. And so he's yearning towards larger circles. And so he came to Berlin. Finally, he saved up some money, and so he came to Berlin. And he found it's very good to pursue spiritual science. He particularly felt in himself a special artistic talent, and so he demanded from the society that the society help to promote his artistic talents. Unfortunately, his productions didn't really demonstrate the presence of a great talent. So he approached different members in order to promote and help him. And they all advised him to really try to study and to learn. But he wanted to exercise his art without, he didn't want to learn, because he had the view that he knew better than the teachers who tried to teach him. So he went from one teacher to another teacher. He came to the conclusion how terrible the world is, because the world never recognizes a developing genius. So it went with this human, this person, as it goes with many others. First, they try to seek for some sort of promotion within our society, and if, according to their viewpoint, they do not receive this promotion, then they become opponents. And then they come up with all sorts of things. But what exists behind these things, naturally, they obviously don't tell about. Here we have the case of a person who is permeated by a pathological vanity combined with an incapacity. Propositions that all sorts of journals are only too eager to accept articles from such a person. And the person I'm talking about is named Eric Bamler. Take another case. A person who precisely did not lack in vanity. Several years ago, first he was had all sorts of things to oppose against anthroposophy, but finally he entered anthroposophy. And I was the last person in the world who would have fetched this personality, but he found himself into anthroposophy. Again, he tried to develop all sorts of personal goals in our society, and naturally people did not accede to it. In the first stages of his association with us, he was very satisfied with us. He actually wrote a manuscript, and I actually permitted myself to write an afterword, a nachwort, and write some concluding remarks, and this writing was taken up in our publishing house. It was very good with us. We were people whom you could talk to. Then this particular person printed another manuscript and another writing. And after this particular writing had passed through many kinds of destinies, which we won't go into, he requested that the Philosophical Anthroposophical Verlag should take it up. However, it was impossible for us to take up this writing into our publishing house. In this writing, the person said that I, Rudolf Steiner, have merely indicated certain aspects about the Christ problem, but now this individual is going to develop this thing in greater detail. Actually, in this thesis of this person, this writing, this person took together things that I have said in my lectures and put them all together. Since he claimed to have had details which he did not get from these lectures but which came from himself, it was natural that Frau Dr. Steiner refused to publish this particular thesis of his. Now, this person became an opponent of our movement. All sorts of things in periodicals against our movement. And so we can see that this opposition of Herr Max Seiling can be directly led to the fact that our publishing house refused to publish his thesis. Now, let me tell you about another situation. There's a certain person who earlier on was in America, but who is now, but actually it was a good European, was several years previously inspired by one of our good members to come to Germany, and here he listened to all sorts of lectures which I gave. Now the publisher makes a note. He says the person that Steiner is talking about is Max Heindel, who is a Dane who called himself Grashof in Berlin. This person with great industry tried to get all the lectures which were held in previous years. After he got all this stuff together, he returns back to America. There in America, he said that he certainly was here, that he became familiar with my teaching, but he could not be completely satisfied with my teaching, but he had to go much more deeply. Hence, with him, you will find many things which are not yet in my books. After he had explored everything that he could find with me, he was called upon to go to a certain master who is situated in the Transylvanian Alps, and this master then imparted to him a great deal which he now incorporated into his book. Actually, everything which he incorporated in his book was what he had gotten from the lectures which he heard and which he wrote down. And then this book was called The Rosicrucian World Conception. This book appeared in America and aroused a great deal of interest there. So this book was combined with everything which he had heard here from me, and then combined with what was purported to have told him by the master in the Transylvanian Alps. There in America, there was published a great deal which had been lectured here in our members' lectures, in our internal lectures. There was not enough that an Anglo-American book was written, but this book actually was translated and appeared in a German translation. And the person who published it was Dr. Folrat. My dear friends, it's very important that you know all about these things. It's how people utilize what they can get from us, and how they, on the other hand, they battle us. I've told you about these things in previous occasions, and I talk and talk about these things, but it goes on deaf ears. Hence, it remains nothing other than to attach a certain iron necessity. My dear friends, let's assume that spiritual science would appear as literature. Then it would be quite impossible for all the things that have happened to our science of the spirit, which have happened, and which have been the most unworthy things that have happened. What we must be able to distinguish from the spiritual scientific movement, which is a purely cognitive movement, which wants to be purely a world conception movement of the present time, what we must distinguish from the spiritual scientific movement is the Anthroposophical Society. As an idea, the Anthroposophical Society is very good as an idea, but in actual practice, so many things occur, things, and I'm not exaggerating, so many things occur which show that within this Anthroposophical Society, quite easily special cliques develop, cliques with personal interests, pro and contra, things which develop themselves in the most plentiful way. It is very difficult to separate the personal interests from the pure objective interests in the ground of a society. Bear in mind, through that very fact, gates are opened through which the scientific, through which the societies, which the society opens itself for those people who do not want to enter into an honest discussion of the science of the spirit, but they want, on the bypath of personal, using personal calumnies to cause damage to spiritual science by such slanders and libels. They want to ruin the science of the spirit. For many years, I have decided, it's been my habit, to meet the wishes of the different members for personal interviews. Reference to the most recent members and the oldest members, and I've done this in a very amplified way. But in recent years, I had to reduce this custom. I quite often have to emphasize already that in what you have in the literature and what is said in the lectures, the person can make himself study those things, and that's all what's already there, that's all you need for your own independent development. I've had personal discussions with this member or that member. And some people are very satisfied when they say, I have become an esoteric student. And this person can say to the other person, I know something very mysterious and secret, and about that I can't tell you. All this has led to a great deal of trouble in the society. Certain few people have begun to misuse this. And naturally, in the society, there can be friendly interaction. However, the iron necessity forces me to stop giving private audiences. Now, it makes me very sad to have to do this, because many people will say, why should the innocent suffer because of the guilty? When you're in a society, so is that obviously the karma of the society, and the situation cannot be done any other way. Of course, things which I've told people in private audiences have been distorted and have led to the evil calumnies. Very bad things have happened. For example, it reached the point where it has been suggested that this or that member has been hypnotized. Now I have to start a new policy, initiate a new policy in which everything that we do here should be completely placed in the light of publicity. If, for example, everything we do is done in complete publicity, no more private things, then the causes for all these calumnies will be withdrawn. Hence, in future, what develops itself in the anthroposophically orientated science of the spirit, more and more will have to be done in the light of the public. So today, I expressly declare the following situation. In relationship to those private conversations which have occurred for many years with members, I release every person from a promise not to speak about the content of these conversations. Everybody can, as much as he likes, to impart and to tell other people of what occurred in a private conversation. Nothing will be there which shies away from the light of the public, of openness. Let me give you an example of the sort of things that have been happening. Not only that Eric Bamler, but many others who oppose us as much as he does. These people have maintained that among many other things which have been presented to them as esoteric fundamental principles, here is one of the things. They say it was an esoteric fundamental principle. Look on everything which surrounds you as occurring in the light of necessity. If it was necessary, as a necessarily given destiny. It's quite well when you're in within a society, when you have received such a rule to say, I am an esoteric student, because I continuously meditate on the following fact. I meditate upon the fact of looking around you, see everything around you, and consider everything around you in the light of necessity. I'm an esoteric student because I meditate on this proposition. The question is, why was these people given this rule? The answer is, for the simple reason, because they needed it according to their soul constitution. It's an advice whose amplitude and esotericism they had to come to some judgment about. And you realize this when I point out to you the following situation. Schopenhauer, in his prize article about the freedom of the will, says near the end of his thesis, in relationship to our connection with our relationship to destiny and the course of the world, he says the following. We quote Schopenhauer. He says, everything which occurs, occurs of necessity. Everything from the greatest to the smallest occurs out of necessity. And he speaks about the calming effect of the knowledge of that which is unavoidable and is of necessity. Here was something given, the same as Schopenhauer did, but was given for a special reason, in order to enable certain people to be able to get out of certain soul depressions. So we see an example of things I've told people in private to meet their own particular situation, those things being told to other people and then distorted and taken out of context. And so even though it hurts me, I'll have to no longer have any private discussions with people, no more private audiences. Even this decision of mine will cause many slanders to be directed against me. However, I have to follow this particular precept because it's necessary for our movement. Many years previously I warned you about this, but people didn't listen to me. But the people outside our society claim that my great failing is that I make blind adherents out of my students. The actual truth is that things happen are the reverse of what my opinion is. Quite often people have asked me my opinion, and then they have given their own opinion and told other people that's what I said. It was very far removed from saying what this person thought he heard I said, because he wanted to hear, that's what he wanted me to say. But actually, I didn't say what he thought I did say. In the external world, people say we have blind adherence here. The actual practice shows the quite reverse. At present time, we see small snowballs gathering in the distance. And it's good to realize that, because if the snowballs carry on, they can become a huge avalanche and bury our movement. And we have to emphasize a new system that everything of spiritual science must occur in complete openness. In connections, this should be different, but that can only occur when the members become different. And he ends the lecture.